So it's a little obvious what we're going over today. You can see right in front of you. It's no surprise. So I figured we'd take a look at some prophecy. I told you early on, this isn't my favorite subject, but it is a necessary subject. So I do like to touch on things when it comes to prophecy. And today I think it'll be good to focus on the abomination of desolation. And we see a lot of different things going on in the world. It raises a whole bunch of different questions. And this is mentioned in the Olivet Prophecy. We see it touching on this in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. We get some of this. When we think about this name, it's a terrifying name in general. Abomination of desolation. It doesn't sound like anything good can come of it. And it really doesn't. It's not a good message. It's not fun. There's nothing pleasant about it. But what exactly does it mean? Where does it lead us, and what can we use from it? And when we look at prophecy, we have to be careful that we don't try to make too much out of some of the information that we're given. We don't have to try to get every single detail so that we know every minute instance of what's going to happen and the exact day, the exact time, the exact year. Historically, we've done that, and those dates and times passed, and we realized we made a mistake. We don't do that anymore because God gives us some information, but He doesn't give us all information. He gives us the understanding of the overview of specific ideas. And He gives us that overview with most of the prophecies. It doesn't matter whether it's Armageddon, whether it's the day of the Lord, or the abomination of desolation. He gives us the pieces that we need to keep us motivated on the path that He has set for us. Not so that we can know every little detail and understand every piece of this. Because understanding the overview, understanding the idea of what God wants from us, helps us to understand the Bible and its history of what's happening. It also gives us some of the future. He unfolds some of God's plan of what is in store for us, what's coming down the pipeline. And it's intended, prophecy is intended to help us with our faith. To make our faith stronger. So we have a reliance on God. We have a trust in God that His plan is happening. His plan is going to continue to happen. All the way to the very end. So we don't have to question that. And, you know, prophecy, the intention isn't that we have all the inside information. Oftentimes we think that's what it's about. That we have this knowledge that nobody else does. Something outside of what everybody else can understand and comprehend. But that's not what it is. It's not a special knowledge. We see in the first century church, they combated Gnosticism left and right. There are all these ideas of this special knowledge, a higher knowledge than everybody else, and we were better than everybody else because we have this special knowledge, special details that God has given us. But we find that what happens is when we start digging for special knowledge, something that nobody else has, we end up going down that rabbit hole. We find ourselves in that rabbit hole, lost, stuck in the rabbit hole, looking for the same things over and over again. We get distracted from the main reason of why we're here. The main reason of what He gave us these details for. And if you're not a Christian, prophecy, knowing it, is meaningless. If you're not a Christian, it doesn't help you. But to know prophecy as a Christian, it gives us details. It gives us some foresight, and it helps us with our faith. Understanding that God's plan is happening. God's plan is working. It gives us confidence that we're on the right path. We're on the right track. And the abomination of desolation, it's one of those examples. It's one of the examples that we have where we can see God's plans working. We'll end up, as we go through this, this is going to be a two-parter again. I was going to try to crank through some of this, some of these details, and try to get through all of it. And I realized that what was probably going to happen is I was going to start muddying words, and I was going to start muddying ideas, and I was going to make it more confusing, and I was going to confuse everybody even worse than we already are. And that wouldn't be good. So I picked a point where I think it'll be a good transition point between today, and in 2 weeks I'll do the rest of it. But what we're going to find out is that there have actually been two instances of past fulfillments, partial fulfillments of the abomination of desolation. It's happened twice in history. We can go through that. And so today we're going to go through one of those. But what it does, that helps us to understand the future. That helps us to understand what's coming because we've seen it in the past. Not because God just gives us all the details and said, this is what you're looking for. But we can use history and the experience of what we've been given in the Bible. And looking at the past fulfillments helps us to understand that the Bible is true. That it is truth. It gives us some of the details, but not all of the details. So some of the things that we're going to look at today are actually criticized by biblical scholars and people who write some of the commentaries. It's just completely scrutinized because they believe that these prophecies were written down after they happened. Well, what does that mean? If those were written down after it happened, it's no longer prophecy. It's history. They did research, and it's a historical moment. So they don't believe that these were prophecies. They don't believe that the timeline of the Bible is accurate, or that the people lived in the times that they were, or the prophecies were given in the specific times. But we believe in the chronology of the Bible. We believe that Daniel lived at that time frame before these occurrences happened, and that he prophesied about them, and then in the future, they came true. That's our faith. That's our belief of what we have. We know that they were written in the Bible for a specific purpose to help us and guide us. So let's start out by going over to Daniel 12. We're going to spend a lot of time in Daniel. Actually, I don't think we go anywhere else today. But that's where we're going to start. And at the end of the book of Daniel, Daniel 12, Daniel is actually a very fascinating book because it contains prophecy and history. There's a combination of what's going on, of what Daniel lived through. Some very important things in his time and his life of what he experienced. Because there were examples of prophecies that he gave in his lifetime that were fulfilled in his lifetime. He not only had the prophecy, but he saw it fulfilled. He saw what happened. And we're not going to stop and look at every single one of the details of all of these. But we want to get at this broad picture so that we can understand and understand a definition of what the abomination of desolation is. So we're going to go through Daniel 12 as we look at this and try to define what the abomination of desolation is and what that means to us. It'll help us to figure out what we're looking for, because that's the questions that we tend up having. We want to know, what are we looking for? What are the things that are going to occur that we really need to pay attention to? Those big signs that, okay, this is unfolding now. This is the next step of God's plan. And it's because Jesus said, look for it. He told us. He said, you're supposed to look for this. And we may think, what am I supposed to look for? You didn't really lay it out nice and neat for me, but he did. He did. There's ways that we see that. So what is it? What are we looking for? And that's what we want to define today. And that's why we're going through this. So we're going to start out. If you look at Daniel chapter 12, we're going to look at the first three verses here. It says, at that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the star, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So then, basically, after this, Daniel's told, you have no idea what this means. Congratulations, I've given you information, but you don't know what it is. You don't understand what this is. He says, write it down, seal it up, and we're gonna reveal this in the future. So we find this actually multiple times with Daniel, of where he's given this information, and then he's not really told exactly what it is. And could you imagine how distraught this would make you feel? You're given bits and pieces of information, little snippets of what's going to happen, whether it's in visions from God. You know they're not normal dreams. These aren't just everyday dreams that you're having, but these are specific visions from God. Now, other times, angels talked specifically to him and told him different pieces of this. Could you imagine the amount of weight that would put on you? Not only if we think about Daniel was removed from his home and taken to another country. Do you imagine being snatched up right now, taken over to Europe or Asia, and then you start having visions and angels are talking to you. There's a weight to that. There's an amount of pressure that comes with that. And we're trying to live our lives the best we can in the situations that we have here and now. And we think they're bad. But Daniel was going through some difficult things. There had to have been a lot of anxiety that he was feeling and experiencing because of his situations. So what exactly do we know from this? What are the different points that we can take away? The facts that we can take away? And this entire chapter 12 is about the end time. The end in time. And it concerns this time when God intervenes in human history. God takes a major role in what's happening with us and where we go. Now, this isn't the destruction of humanity. That'd be pointless for God to create humanity just to destroy humanity. That's not what the end time is. The end time, it's far beyond that. It's the end of humankind, but it's the beginning of a much bigger God kind. That family of God that he's working on building right now with us. That's the plan. That's the plan that's going to be opened up to all of humanity, is to become no longer humankind, but God kind. That's this process that we're going through. And it's scary. People dread this. People dread what's coming because oftentimes it's not a friendly or happy idea, especially when we start talking about people burning for eternity in hell. That's not something pleasant. So people have this anxiety and this fear over some of these things. When we look at the big picture of what's going to happen, what God's doing, it's a really good thing. Yes, it's the end of humanity, but that's because we become a God kind. We become something different. We're no longer physical human beings. That's because God sends Christ to intervene once again in our behalf, for us. He intervenes in human history. One of the things that we do know that's going to happen is that the sacrifices are going to be stopped. They're not going to take place any longer. You may think, oh, how do you know that? Well, we haven't read it yet, but we're going to go there. If we drop down to verse 11, we go down to verse 11, we can take a look here, and it gives us some information as to what's going to take place, what some of these things that we can work through that he has given us, the specific details. And we can think about all of this is happening at that end time. In Daniel 12, verse 11, it says, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days." 1,290 days. So we just cherry-picked a few things out of chapter 12. We've gone through here and picked some pieces out. This entire chapter is about the end-time prophecy. And these events, that it's very clear that the sacrifices are going to be stopped. Whatever that may be. It also tells us that the abomination of desolation is going to be set up. It seems like that's going to go hand in hand. When those sacrifices stop, the abomination of desolation will be set up. And that's going to happen for 1,290 days. So we're given bits and pieces. We're given some specific details. Not the year, not the day, but he's given us some information. It may pop into your mind, well, I want all the details. We like to know all the details. We want to know those. Because then we can start planning for those. Most of humanity, on some degree, we are planners. There are some of those who fly by the seat of their pants, but that's only to some extent. We like to know everything. Now, I'm sorry to disappoint you. This is about all the information you're going to get from me when it pertains to the end time and what's going to happen. We could end right there, I guess, at the end of the sermon. Done. That wouldn't be much of a sermon. Well, we are given some different aspects. When we talk about the full fulfillment of what's coming, yeah, we don't have all the details. We don't have all the insight. But because of those past fulfillments, we're able to gain a little bit deeper knowledge. We can gain some more information on what to do and how to handle it. And we see all of this. We know this is the end time. We know chapter 12 because it talks about the resurrections, right? That section that we read, verses 1 through 3, it lumped up the resurrections. And Daniel combines those two. So we know there are multiple resurrections that are going to take place. You know, we have the saints at the first resurrection, at the second resurrection. It's going to be those who never had an opportunity. And then there's going to be another one that's basically for destruction. And he wraps this together. He wraps all that in a nice little package and basically says, all right, this section is about this time period. It's about this time period. But that's not our focus today. We're not going to drill into these any further than what we've already touched on. But it gives us the understanding that during this time, there's a great trouble. That there's something that's has this big impact. After this great trouble, this all leads to this time where there's no longer sacrifices. The sacrifices are ceased, and the abomination is going to be set up. The abomination of desolation will be set up, and we're going to see this for 1290 days. We're not going to go into the 1290 days either. That's a whole separate sermon for another time. You're going to learn a lot about this. We want details, details, details. We want to go thoroughly through this stuff, but we have to pick and choose what pieces we get, or when we're going to go through these, because that's a whole other subject. That's not the topic of this abomination of desolation as far as what we need to get into and understand what's going to happen. We're here to define the abomination of desolation and get as much information about that as we can. And we do that when discussing prophecy. We have former, we have latter fulfillments. And that's what's going to give us the information to define the abomination of desolation. There's partial fulfillments that have happened in history that we know have already happened. There's records of these events taking place, and there's details about what happened and how it happened. We're given some insight into Scripture through historical events. These historical events that were actually prophesied about. And we can start adding up all the pieces into the chronology of Scripture. And we understand what it is and what it means. And therefore, we find prophecies that are either partially fulfilled or they've been fully fulfilled. And then we have prophecies that are going to be fulfilled in the future. It makes it really muddy water and really difficult to follow at times, but we can walk through this and look at the details. And that's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at two partial fulfillments of the abomination of desolation that helps us to understand what it is that's going to happen in the future. We're given some details outside of what the end time is, the 1290, the ceasing sacrifices, and the abomination of desolation. So, we can think about Daniel here. And some of that, I'm trying to use the slides. I'm not going to read everything on the slides because I'm basically going to talk more about those topics, but I figured that'd be a good way for you guys to be able to keep notes if you're wanting to try to get through some of this. So as we skim through chapter 12, we're not going to get through it into much detail. And we see that these prophecies and the resurrections and this basis of what the abomination desolation is, I hope that makes sense and it's not too confusing, because when it sounds like we're going to explain something, we think we're going to get into all the details. And that's not always the way the Bible works. We have to completely put aside any guessing game that we have. Anytime that we want to draw and try to jump to conclusions, that's what we have to try to make sure that we don't get to. But what we can do, we can actually construct bits and pieces of details out of what God is doing or has done in the past to help us to get to the future. And so we're going to stay in Daniel. So just a little bit of background about Daniel. It's assumed that he was from an upper class family. We know that he was an Israelite, that it's likely that he was from a royal family. There was some prestige to who he was and who he came from. We also know that when Babylonians came and defeated them, invaded in 605 BC, that they took a whole bunch of the young men with them. They basically took them back to Babylon, from Israel to Babylon, and they were taken. They did this with all the civilizations that they conquered. It was part of what the Babylonian society did. And they did it for a specific reason. It's actually really smart of what they did. Because they picked and choose. They picked the brightest. They picked the wealthy. They picked the ones that were going to have some prestige, have high roles in society, they took all of these young men, oftentimes teenagers probably, or younger. We're not exactly sure, but we know they were young. So they took all of these young men, and they took them back to Babylon. What they did, they took these bright men, and they converted them into Babylonians. They converted them to Babylonians for a very specific purpose, because at some point, they were planning on sending them back. But before they sent them back, what they wanted to do, they wanted to teach them, because they knew that they were going to rule their nation someday. They were going to have positions of power. And so what they were going to do, they were going to take them to Babylon, train them, and then send them back. That gave this relationship with Babylon. That gave the people who were going to be in charge this loyalty to the Babylonian Empire. So they had a lot less trouble with them because they'd actually trained them. They used these wise men, these young boys, taught them how to be Babylonians, trained them, educated them, and then they sent them back. I'm sure they learned some different things from them as well about the other civilizations, which helped them. Daniel didn't fall into that mold. Daniel was a different story, because that was the pattern that they saw of what they did with the people. Daniel ended up spending the rest of his life in Babylon. He spent the rest of his life as an advisor. He never got sent back to his homeland. So when he got removed from his country, he never got to return. But he did become a great advisor to multiple kings throughout the time. One of the major events that we see that God was with him, God was leading his path, was when he first met King Nebuchadnezzar. There was this time where King Nebuchadnezzar was considered probably the greatest king of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire. And he had a dream. You may remember a little bit about what this dream was, but what he did was a little bit unique. So he had this dream. He brought in all of his advisors, any of the magicians, the soothsayers, anybody in his, what we would consider a cabinet, all of these advisors, he brought them in and he goes, "Guys, I had this dream. I need you to tell me what the dream was, and I need you to interpret the dream." Could you imagine somebody bringing you in and they go, "Hang on, you want us to tell you the dream? Like, how about you tell us the dream, and then we'll interpret it for you?" And he goes, no. He says, "If I tell you the dream, you're just going to make something up, and then I'm still not going to have any better idea of what we're going through or what I'm dealing with." And they go, "We can't do that. We can't tell you your dream." He goes, "Well, you're no good. I'm going to kill all of you." So he starts this plan to gather up all of his advisors, and he was planning on killing them. Well, fortunately, God intervened because he gave to Daniel what the dream was, and he also gave him what the meaning was. Now, we're not going to get into this much detail, but this dream of what Nebuchadnezzar had seen, this lays the framework for what we're looking at with the abomination of desolation. It gives us this outline of exactly what it is that we're walking through and the history behind it. So what we have, this dream, Nebuchadnezzar dreams about this statue that you can see here. It's from chapter 2 of Daniel. And this is what he sees. It's a statue of it. It's just a statue. That's basically what it is. It's got a head of gold. The chest and arms are of silver. It has a belly and thigh of bronze. You got legs and feet of iron. It's a mixture of iron and clay. And then you have this stone. This giant stone not made by human hands. And it ends up coming down and it crushes the legs and the feet of this statue and it crumbles. It collapses down on itself. And so Daniel tells King Nebuchadnezzar this and of course he's like, "That's it! That's it!" He goes, I know your God has told you this because I didn't tell anybody. Because I didn't leak this to anybody. Nobody else had that information." He goes, "I knew that came from God, whoever your God is. He told you that." He says, "So what does it mean? What does this mean?" Because I'm sure in the dream it didn't have the nice words that we get. It's nice that now that we have history, we can start piecing in some of these things. But when, think about Daniel and that dream of just seeing the statue. Just seeing the pieces of the statue in the stone. Without any dates, without any countries. Just the statue. And that's what he was given. That's what God showed him in that dream. He says, so what does it mean? So Daniel said, I'll tell you what it means. God has given me some information. He says, it means there's going to be four great kingdoms. And the first one is Babylonian. Babylon. He says, the first one is your kingdom. It's the Babylonian Empire. And what this shows us the countries that interacted with Jerusalem. And it walks us through that. So we see that the first one is King Nebuchadnezzar's, Babylon. And the second one, they call it an inferior empire, which ends up being Persia. And the third one, it says it was over all the earth, which ends up being Greece. And the fourth one, he doesn't say what it is exactly, but it says that it is strong as iron. It's as strong as iron. What's nice is he does say what the stone is going to be. God's very specific when it comes to the Messiah coming back. What the role of the Messiah is going to be. What Jesus Christ will do when he returns. He's going to crush the kingdoms that have ever existed on this earth. Defeat them. And restructure it as the way that God wants it to be done. The plans that God had from the very beginning. We know this historically. We know that this works out because either you have had or you will have in the near future a history class. What's neat is Babylon fell in a single night. I always find it interesting that it talks about Persia being an inferior empire, yet it only took them one evening. One night. And they were able to overcome the Babylon. Babylon was destroyed by Persia. And we start to fit different pieces of the prophecy. And we start to see these beginning fulfillments. You may remember the finger that was on the wall. It says there was a finger that wrote and it basically told Babylon, your time's up. This is it. This is the extent of your rule over the kingdoms. They knew it wasn't going to last forever. But Babylon thought they were still, they thought it was a joke. There was no way that they were going to get stopped where they were. They were still a powerhouse. They weren't struggling for anything. So they end up, they're having this big party. They're having a big party because the Persians were outside their gates. They couldn't get in. The Persians couldn't get in. Nobody's ever been able to breach the walls. Babylon was a monster of an empire. They were strong. They could sit inside their fortified city and last, it seemed like, forever without any care or concern. They had plenty of food. They had a river that actually ran through. So they had plenty of that. They had a well-stocked, well-supplied army. They had no cares. Other empires that were trying to breach their walls, they couldn't get in. They couldn't get in. They were able to outlast any buddy who tried to defeat them. That's what they'd do. They just waited out. They'd wait till the other empire got weaker, got tired, and then they destroy them. That's how Babylon continued to be this main role. Well, Persians may be inferior, but they were a little bit smarter. What they ended up doing, they ended up rerouting the river that ran through the city. So they basically rerouted the water. As the night went on, the Babylonians continued to party and drink and get drunk. The water level lowered. It lowered below the gates. They walked in under the gate without any problem. And the next morning when the Babylonians woke up from their drunken slumber, they were an occupied city. They were no longer in control. With all the power that they had, all it took was diverting the water flow. And they were overrun. They were overrun. And this prophecy, it only had one fulfillment. Babylon was going to be conquered by Greece, or by Persia. That's what we see. It happened. It's done. That's a one-time fulfillment. And what we're dealing with is not that simple. It's not that simple. We have to look at different details of different historical events to try to get a big picture of what we're going on with. And from your high school world history class, we understand that Greece ended up defeating Persia, and that then the Roman Empire ended up defeating Greece. And that we know that historically. We have the records of that. We know Rome, the Western Empire, fell in the 400s, and it wasn't until about the 1400s that the Eastern Empire fell. But we know, because of prophecy, that in some sense, one way or another, that the Roman Empire is going to last in some fashion until the Messiah returns. Because we've been given the prophecy. We can see that that is what is destroyed by the Messiah when he returns. That's why we've historically looked to Europe and tried to piece together what we can, and sometimes we've jumped to conclusions. But that's not what we're going to do. We're not going to jump to conclusions. We're sticking with historical facts to give us the details of what we're going to, where we're going to go next. We want to stick to what we do know for certain. You can turn over to Daniel chapter 8. If you go to Daniel chapter 8, Daniel 7 talks about the prophecy about those beast powers of chapter 2. It's a vision again, and a lot of people struggle to make sense of what those mean, these beasts. But what it honestly is doing, it just starts to tie together some of those empires, those four empires that we just talked about. And so we have those four empires that we see multiple times given different details about, and that's what chapter 7 goes over. But in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel had a vision of a ram and a goat. And this vision of this ram and goat, we would have no idea what it means except for that we can watch historical events and that God gives us some information about it. So there's many different explanations out there to exactly what this means. And the only reason we know is because God told it. God gave the explanation. Because Daniel didn't know it either. Daniel didn't know exactly what it was. And it's a vision of this ram and this goat. And it's really strange. It really is a strange vision. When we start looking at some of this and understanding, you know, if any of us had a vision like this, we'd probably think we were losing our mind a little bit. There was something wrong. And we'd start questioning, all right, what did I eat last night before I went to bed? Just because it's weird. And, you know, but at the same time, we can look at what's going on right now. I don't think any of us thought we were going to be quarantined for 4 months, and now we're told by states and governments that, you know, we have to wear masks, we can't get 6 feet from each other, or you need to stay 6 feet away, no more hugging and handshaking. None of us saw ourselves here. So maybe it's not as far-fetched as we think. But he has this vision, this dream. So this vision that he's standing on the banks of a canal. It's in the city of Shushan. What ends up happening, there's a ram that has two horns. So he's standing on this canal bank. He sees this ram. It's got two horns. It ends up being one of the horns in the vision is actually a little bit higher than the other. So it's not a normal looking ram that we would normally see. These offset horns. Occasionally we get a ram that's a little different with horns, but not to the extent that Daniel sees. So we have this one that's higher than the other, and he notices that it's not just a normal ram. Not only just because of these offset horns, but this ram goes around trampling every other animal. Just completely smashing, going everywhere at once, and just crushing every other animal that it comes to. All right, so what's that mean? This weird-looking ram that just goes around destroying every other animal. I have no idea what the other ones are, but I would assume that it's not just little bunny rabbits. I'm assuming that there's probably some bears and lions and some things that a ram normally wouldn't defeat. But this ram goes around and just tramples it. Goes all over the place. Anything that it comes across. We have to wait just a little bit to find out exactly what this is. So after this ram comes onto the scene, it goes on, and then this male goat appears. And this male goat only has one giant horn. So we had a ram that had two horns offset. This ram has one giant horn. And similar to the ram, this goat's not a normal goat. It's a little different looking. It's a little strange. It doesn't move like an animal. He says it just kind of hovers. It hovers over the ground, not even touching the ground. And it goes all over the place. So he's hovering over the ground, whatever that means. We can't make sense of a lot of this. But the goat charges the ram. This goat with one giant horn charges the ram, smashing the ram's horns and trampling the ram. So he completely crushes this ram that had been going around and trampling everything else. This ram is now trampled by the goat. This ram that had been beating up everything else in its path. So the goat comes along with his one big horn. He just squashes the ram. No trouble, just completely squashes it. And so the goat becomes great. But what happens is the goat's horn breaks. The one horn breaks, and in its place, four other horns come up. All right, so we start getting bits and pieces of this. What exactly does this mean? So among those four horns that arose, there's one little horn that appears on one of the four. And once again, we were talking about Daniel and these visions and dreams and the prophecies that he's had. So he wakes up from this dream, this vision that he just had. He has no idea what this vision is. He doesn't understand what it is. He knows it's from God. There's no way that this isn't from God. From his life experience, he knows, all right, there's something special about this. And so he knows this is from God, but he has no idea how to piece it together. And it doesn't make sense. But what we can do, we can start looking. If you look at Daniel chapter 8, if you look at verse 9, we're going to read just a little bit of what we saw. It says, therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. So here we see that's not the one I want. Let's see. It's the verse right after that. If we look at verse 9. I don't know if I said 9 or I said 8. I read 8. Verse 9 says, and out of one of them came a little horn and grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. That glorious land is a key. It's a insight of information as to what we're dealing with here. Because the glorious land is really important. The glorious land is the promised land. It's Jerusalem. So it gives us a little bit of information as to what's going on here. So then if we continue on, if you look at verse 10 and 11, it says, and it grew up to the host of heavens, and it cast down some of the hosts and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the hosts. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. So, we see here again these removal of sacrifices in this vision. We have something real happening. This isn't just a vision, something in his mind. But something physical is taking place. And like in what we read in Daniel chapter 12, we see sacrifices stopped. But we see this correlation between the two. So what we're seeing here in 12 and 8, chapter 12 and chapter 8, is this reference to each other. But they end up being two separate instances. We see two separate accounts of what's happening. Let's continue on, verse 13. It says, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? In verse 14 it says, and he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Shall be cleansed. All right, so to add more, we have another time period. We have 2,300 days. We have 2,300 days now. And that's a little different than what we were given before. That's different than the sacrifices that were stopped for 1,290 days. So, we know that this is a separate account. This is a separate occurrence from that end time prophecy of what we read in chapter 12. That this has to be taking place at a different time. So what exactly does it mean? What are we talking about here now? What are we given? Daniel doesn't even know. Daniel's confused about what he has. So God sends an angel to him to help him to understand what this means. If you drop down to verses 18 and 19, this is where it begins to become more clear, where we can start finding some details to exactly what we're talking about, what it was that we saw from this ram and this goat, and what we're dealing with. Daniel 8, verse 18, it says, "Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, 'Look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at that the appointed time, the end shall be.'" So now he comes out of this vision, and he's literally talking to an angel. He wakes up because the angel touched him, and he's talking to this angel about what's going on. And he says, "I'm going to tell you what you just saw. I'm going to give you the information that you're looking for, the bits and pieces of what's happening in the future, what's taking place." Drop down to verse 20. Verse 20 says, "The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is between his eyes is the first king." All right. That's pretty cut and dry. Now we start getting details. We start getting very specific information. It doesn't get any less confusing when he says, "This is Media and Persia, and this is Greece." Here you go. Let me lay it out for you. So if you remember from Daniel chapter 2, that the image of the statue that we looked at, that's our template, right? We have that template, and now we're getting pieces. That's how we piece together where we are historically with what we've looked at. So Babylon was conquered by Persia, which ended up actually being two nations. We oftentimes just say Persia, but it was actually two nations combined. It was Media, the Medes, and the Persians were combined into one kingdom. And we know that historically. And at some point, Persia outgrew the Medes. They became more powerful and stronger. And that's why we see these offset horns in that ram. It makes more sense. This ram with two horns, one was bigger than the other one. That's what we see historically. That's what we deal with. Now if we drop down to verse 21. Verse 21, it says, "And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is between his eyes is the first king." There's our Greece. We see that first king being referenced. Historically, again, we know Greece conquered Persia. That's what we can tell. That's what we have history books that tell us exactly how that happened. This is telling us long before it happened. This dream that Daniel had, it wasn't even close to the time period that it actually takes place. And this prophecy has been fulfilled. Prophecy is done. This is one of the great proofs of the Bible. This is how we can have reassurance that God's plan is working through, is that we see these prophecies. Again, there's people that disagree with that. They say, obviously, this has been written after it happened. There's no way to know this many details about what happened. But we know it did happen. We know that this is the truth. Now we're going to look at verses 22. So, actually, let's go ahead and read verse 21 and 22 again. Move the slides for you. It says, "And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn is between its eyes and is the first king. As for the broken horn, and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of the nation, but not with its power." but not with its power. So what we have here, after the Medes and Persians had already happened, we know that Greece took over. Greece conquered them. What ends up happening is that we see this pattern that we can follow, this historical lineage. Now, we've read a little bit this transgression of desolation, so it changes the name. Well, it gives us the transgression of desolation. It gives us 2,300 days. And so now we can start picking some of these pieces together. So the two-horned goat, it portrayed the empire, the Medes and Persians. All right, we've got that. So that's the obvious things that we get to state. Those are the obvious pieces that we don't have to guess at. We sometimes get ourselves trapped into these points where we start nitpicking at things and scrounging to try to figure out. But with Daniel chapters 2, 7, and 8, we can start tearing this down a little bit more and understanding these different aspects that we're dealing with. Because we see it starts correlating. We see that the sacrifices are being stopped. It's giving us the amount of time that's going to elapse, and we have this abomination of desolation, or the transgression of desolation, as it's called here. And so under Cyrus the Great, Persia became that much greater empire for Persia over the Medes. And we see that they traveled west, north, and south, and that's where they did most of their conquering. And then we have the Greece that came in without touching the ground. Greece was known for moving swiftly. They were known to conquer at a very rapid pace, which makes sense when you're talking about an animal hovering. There's no resistance to what they're able to accomplish. And we know that one of the great kings that they had was Alexander the Great. He was that first king that they're talking about. His father, Philip of Macedonia, was actually trying to unite all the city-states, all the nations, into one. He was trying to get this powerhouse, but he was never able to succeed. So after King Philip, his son Alexander, took over, and he ended up basically conquering the known world. For the world that they did know, Alexander was able to do that, and he did it in a short period of time. Yeah, he didn't travel too far into Western Europe, but he did conquer much of Eastern Europe, Turkey, and clear all the way over into India. And he did it with a relatively small army. There's some historical accounts that it's really quite amazing. They say that he may have had around 30,000 men when he was doing this. He may have only had a small amount of men, which helps us to understand there had to be some divine intervention going on. It's not normal to have that small of an army to be able to conquer the amount of land that he was able to accumulate. There's a couple different reasons for that. Outside of God, we know that Greece used a different fighting style. They used a different fighting style called the phalanx. It's where they lined up into blocks. They had rows of men who had large spears, and they were able to actually defend and move quickly anytime they needed. They had shields that were interlocking. So they had this new fighting style. They had new armor, a different kind of armor that helped equip them for the advances that they were making. And so we see Greece making these huge conquests, but it was very short-lived. Alexander the Great ended up dying in his 30s. Nobody really knows exactly what happened, but he died at an early age. He was this powerhouse. So we see this goat with this one horn, this strong goat, all of a sudden the horn just breaks. In the vision, it talks about at the pinnacle, he was in high power, and it just breaks. It doesn't give any reason or why that would happen. So we see that when that breaks, we have these four horns that end up replacing the one broken horn. We know that when Alexander died at the height of his power, there was no succession plan. There was no king or ruler to take his place, and what ends up happening, Greece gets split up into four different empires. They're all still Greece, but you have this power struggle. And what ends up happening is that these four end up basically developing down into two. But it aligns with the prophecy that Daniel had, that the one broke into four. What we find is that the Seleucids, they were in Syria and Turkey. We see that they were the dominating force up there, and down in Egypt we have the Ptolemy. So these are the two main factors from the Greece Empire. That's what we find after the death of Alexander the Great. And they never end up accumulating the same amount of power. They were never able to get on the same page. So we see under Alexander, they're making these huge conquests. And as soon as he dies, everything just crumbles. Everything crumbles. As we see with humanity, there's a power struggle. And for some reason, they just can never get on the same page. And so it never has the power. They never really learn to work together like they did under Alexander. So what we have here is now we understand the four. We understand the four empires, and then they break down into the two. So what does this have to do with the abomination of desolation? Where does that take us from here? Well, according to Daniel, we can look at verse 23 of chapter 8. Verse 23 says, "And the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors that reach their fulfillment, a king shall rise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes." So now that the Grecian Empire is starting to come to the end, we start to see this. Verse 24 says, "His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people." Again, we're given a little bit of information here that holy people, that's referring to the people of Judah. It gives us a specific location, the ones who came back out of Babylon after they'd been taken away in captivity. So they're now back in Judea at this time. In verses 25 and 26, it says, "Through his cunning he shall cause deceit and prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human hands, or without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future." So if we continue read through here, what happens next is Daniel had this vision. He's woken up. He's talking to the angel about the meaning of the vision. He gives him the details of what exactly this means. You know, if this was us, we'd be thinking, "Oh man, this is great. I'm getting all this information. You're telling me exactly what's going on." I'm getting pumped up, thinking, "Wow, you're telling me exactly what's going to happen." That's not how Daniel reacts. Daniel faints. He just hits the ground. And he ends up being sick for days. And we talked early on about that anxiety, the stress of what he'd been living through. The stress of what God has been using him for. There's a ton of stress that was placed on him. He becomes physically ill. Should help us to realize sometimes we don't need all the details. Sometimes it's better for us not to know the details because it can take a toll on us. But in the future, we see that this is going to happen. Daniel's told exactly what's going to happen, and the angel says, this is what's coming. This is what's going to take place. We don't have to interpret it any further than that. We don't have to start guessing at things. We know a lot more about the prophecy because we saw it historically. We know what happens because it has finally occurred. For Daniel, it hadn't happened yet. But for us, we get to see it from a different viewpoint, a different spectrum. And although he didn't get to see it, we kind of did. We kind of did in our history books. Because Daniel was there when Persia conquered Babylon, and he became the advisor to the Persians once the Babylonians were taken over. He saw some of those prophecies. He saw some of those things truly happen in chapter 2 and chapter 7. Daniel saw pieces of these prophecies being fulfilled. He saw different aspects of it. But there were some that he was given that he saw start, but he never saw finish. He never saw some of these happen. It was long after he died that the Greeks ended up taking over Persia, and now we end up with this small horn. We end up with this small horn, and what does that mean? Because we know that a small horn grew out of one of the four. We have the Seleucus in the Turkey, Syria area, and then we have the Ptolemies that we talked about that were down in Egypt. So this little horn, where does that leave us? The important thing about this little horn is that we know it relates to the glorious land. You remember how we talked about that and making that point of reference of God's holy land, Jerusalem. We know that that's impacted. We know that the sacrifices are stopped. So we start taking all this information that we did have. And so what happened for years, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, they battled. So you have Turkey, you have Syria, and then you have Egypt down here. And these two constantly battled. As I'm battling the microphone. With it, they're constantly battling, fighting. Where are they going through? They're going straight through Jerusalem. They're going through the Holy Land. They're going back and forth. They're fighting back and forth. These two Greek empires, they're supposed to be on the same team. They're supposed to be working together, but they're not. One wants dominating power over the other one. So they're traveling back and forth right through Jerusalem. It's interesting, as archaeologists have uncovered stuff, they found baskets and baskets full of coins. Some from the Ptolemies, some from the Seleucids. And each of them have different faces and of different kings that were in power at different times. They found baskets full of these in Jerusalem. Because that's that middle point where they just constantly went back and forth. They were struggling for power for decades. So what does this leave us with? What does this picture? We have these two Greek groups that continue to battle. Because they just went back and forth through Judea. They trampled that ground back and forth as they're trying to get dominating power. Well, that leaves us with some more information. That gives us some more details as to what's going on. So we have this king who ends up being in the north, the Seleucids. He comes through and he actually ends up conquering Judea. It was about 175 to 164 BC. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was actually the fourth in the line of Antiochus Epiphanes. A lot of times they continue down with the same name, they just had multiple numbers after that. And he invades the Glorious Land. He ends up invading Jerusalem. And just like it said, at a later time, before the Greeks actually fell. So after Daniel's time, this happens. What ends up happening as he invades, as he goes into Jerusalem, he does a couple different things. He forces the Jews to give up their religion. He didn't only make them give up their religion, he stopped their sacrifices. So Antiochus Epiphanes IV, he comes in, he stops sacrifices, he destroys what's in the temple, and he ends up setting up an altar, and he sets up statues to these pagan gods. So he's converting over what was supposed to be holy into pagan rituals. He even took it as far as he ended up sacrificing pigs. He ended up sacrificing pigs in the temple. So he doesn't stop there. That's not the extent of what he did. He really hated the Jews. So he ends up killing anybody who continues in the faith. Anybody who would not turn away from God, he would destroy, completely kill. The rabbis were killed. Anything associated with the Bible, any Bibles they found were burned. He was so cruel that if he found a mother with a baby that was circumcised, he would have the baby killed and he would make the mother wear the baby around their neck as they walked up and down the streets. He was just a cruel and vicious man. Just an evil person who was bloodthirsty. And so we see this bloodbath that happens in Jerusalem. We see that he came, he stopped the sacrifices, and he set up the transgression of desolation. And we see this taking place. We can see it's something that actually happened. It was something that was actually set up in the temple. The sacrifices were stopped. Do you guys remember how long it was supposed to be stopped? Because we were given a time frame of what this would happen. We can go back, look at Daniel 8, verse 13. If we look at verses 13 and 14, if we look at this closely, we're given some information. It says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?'" And then verse 14, it says, "And he said to me, 'For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.'" So we see sacrifices stopped. We see this transgression of desolation, and they're given a time frame of exactly how long this was going to take place. Now, this can be a little tricky. It can be confusing if we don't actually understand what some of these words mean. In Hebrew, it doesn't say 2,300 days. It doesn't say 2,300 days. It says 2,300 evenings and mornings. That takes a different turn for the Jewish people. That means something different to them, because in our English language, we think of a day. We think, all right, we have our morning, we have our evening. That's one day. This is the same thing. It makes sense. It doesn't change anything. 2,300 days or 2,300 mornings and evenings doesn't change anything. But that's the English. Sometimes we have to be careful with what we pull out, because we lose information if we're going based off of what we know now as English. So what evenings and mornings that is actually a reference to is the daily sacrifices that were done in the temple. And daily sacrifices were done in the morning, and they were done in the evening. They were done both. So this reference, how long until it ceases? Well, it's 1,150 days, or 2,300 mornings and evenings. It's 2,300 sacrifices, which breaks that down into half of 1,150. And that's because we have all of this. When Antiochus Epiphanes came into Jerusalem, he was able to stop sacrifices. He was able to set up the transgression of desolation. He stopped both of those things. And coincidentally, about 1,150 days later, there was a revolt. Something happened. We find the Maccabean Rebellion. There were Jewish leaders at that time in the community who formed an army, the Maccabees. They set up this army and defeated Antiochus Epiphanes. And it was about 1,150 days after Antiochus Epiphanes had defeated Jerusalem. And so what they ended up doing, they ended up pushing all the Greeks out, and they set the Jewish nation up, an independent Jewish nation. And in doing so, they cleaned out the temple, they reset all of God's laws, of what it was that he wanted done, and how it was supposed to be done. And that's what we read. It said, if you remember, that the temple would be cleansed. We see this taking place. And they brought the Levites again. They started sacrificing to God for a period of time. The Jewish nation returned to worshiping God in a correct manner under the Maccabean rule. So we see elements of this, of what the end time abomination of desolation is going to actually take place and how it's going to happen. So that's why we don't have to figure out the difference between the 1,290 days in the 2,300. It's because they're two completely different events. We don't have to try to align them up and start calculating out, well, if you take out this day for this or this day for that, we don't have to do any of that. We don't have to make things up, because they're two different events. One already happened, and one is still planned to happen. But what happens with these previous fulfillments is that historically we can pull some information from it. We can pull some information of it. You may question, okay, how confident are we that this transgression of desolation actually aligns with what the abomination of desolation in the future is going to be? It's not many things that mainstream Protestants, some Catholics, evangelicals, Seventh-day Adventists, and us all agree on. This is one of them. Why? Because it's history. It's a historical event that we can watch line up. And we have an agreement that this is what this means. We don't have to try to guess and grab at some of these. And this is why some commentators say that this was written well after Daniel's time. It's because they say these details are too specific. The details of what happened match up too closely for this to be a prophecy. They don't believe in prophecy. They're too exact. It couldn't have been before that. And so they discredit all prophecy. And they say, okay, this was written after the events took place. We know that's not how it happened. We know that Daniel was given the prophecies. We don't have to guess that it was written afterwards. We believe that scripture and the chronology of the account of the Bible is true. And that's what we rely on. So, sorry, these prophecies actually happened. these prophecies took place. And we understand that this is the first abomination of desolation. We can see these pieces line up. You could also call it the transgression of desolation. It uses that name in Daniel. But we see that this takes place. And we see that we have details that help us to understand those. Now, this was a terrible thing that happened. And in doing so, we begin to understand the pieces that we pick out. We see the sacrifice stopping. We see the abomination of desolation being set up. We're given a time frame as to how long that'll happen. Now, all of these things correlate with what we're looking for with the abomination of desolation that's going to come in the future. What's going to take place at some point in the future is what we need to rely on, that this has happened already. We can see these events, and it's going to be similar. It's going to resemble these same features. So we have this king who wants to destroy God, basically wants to destroy God. He hates anything related to God, the people who worship God. He wants them destroyed. He's that little horn. He was that little horn. He's part of that Greek empire. So we see the prophecy playing out, and he's part of that goat. He's part of that goat that destroyed the ram. And we start piecing all of that out and understand what the kingdoms were and the armies that invaded Jerusalem. We see the violent sanctions that he placed on the Jewish people. We see the violence that he bestowed upon not just the people themselves, but the sacrifices to God by stopping them. And what he did in the temple, he set up the new regulations of what would be sacrificed and what altars were in there, what statues were in there. It wasn't anything that correlates to worshiping God. Nothing that references our worship to our Father. It has nothing to do with that. But he set up all the pagan statues and he stopped the true sacrifices. And that gets us to this point where we understand the transgression of desolation, or the first abomination of desolation. So what we can do, we can take this, and we can take those bits. And that's where I'm going to stop today. In 2 weeks, we'll go over the second instance of where the abomination of desolation occurs. It's going to be in 70 AD with the Roman Empire, but we'll go through some of those details of how it happened, and we can see how it correlates, how these same instances of the sacrifices being stopped, pagan rituals being done where the temple should have been. But it gets us to this idea of, okay, God doesn't give us all the details. He doesn't give us all the information that we think we have to have. But he gives us enough that we know we need to keep working. And when we start seeing things play out, when we start seeing men come into a role, into a position that they can start having an impact like this, we start becoming aware. And we don't need to know the exact time. We don't need to know the exact days because we know what the events and the ideas that we need to look for. So that's where we're going to leave us today. We'll pick this back up in 2 weeks.